coming up on Tech Nation, the second part of a two-part series on digital health. I speak with Dr. Rajay Bhatnigi. He's a co-founder and the chief health officer of Collective Health. The company started when the CEO became hospitalized and seriously ill. He had 65 claims against his health insurance and was getting nowhere. Then on Biotech Nation, stopping blood loss in humans with some pretty nifty technology. Whether by accident or during the course of a medical procedure, this blood loss technique has been decades in the making. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
I'm loving every article I read about IBM's much-publicized technology breakthrough. The media generally describe it as the ability to store data in a single atom. But frankly, that's for general consumption. It's actually the ability to direct a single atom to be in one magnetic state or another, to have it remain in that state, and then to be able to detect which state it's in. When you say it that way, it doesn't sound like much, which is why you might call a description which reads, "the ability to store data in a single atom," a whole lot of hype. It does not mean that there's a single atom in which you could store a Netflix file, or a Word document, or your email. Well, at least not yet anyway. So for the time being and for some time to come, it's a fantastic breakthrough to be able to deliberately get an atom to be in one of two magnetized states, to observe that the atom stays in that state unless tampered with, and to be able to detect which magnetic state the atom is in. You might wonder why this has computer scientists and engineers dancing in the streets, or at the very least, whistling happily at their computer desks and texting their friends. It's pretty simple, and I'll tell you why. Computer scientists and engineers know that every bit of digital storage that has ever been built was built on the ability to make something physical be in one of two different states, that the states would stay that way, and that technology could detect which state it was in. IBM's breakthrough means that decades of that know-how can be applied all over again. If you haven't already guessed it, you should know that this two stable states with ability to both detect and set approach to storage technology is in some form or another at the base of the storage in every laptop or computer you've ever owned or used, on every cell phone and smartphone you've ever owned or used, and in every one of those USB memory sticks which are scattered all over your life, from your office to your computer bag to the junk drawer in your kitchen. To be sure, there's plenty of work to be done here yet. But when engineers say, this is now a previously solved problem, it's like a wide receiver who catches the football, turns, and realizes he's got an open field run. The truth is, engineers can take anything that takes on two different states and make a data storage system. And as with so many things, size matters. That single atom, which can be in two different states, which we call 0 and 1, for IBM, it can now be done in a single atom. On your hard drive, the material it takes to store that 0 or 1, it takes some 100,000 atoms. Yep, do the math. In digital storage, as in golf, a low score is a very good thing. At the same time, while technology is getting tinier, humans are still just about the same size. If I gave you a USB drive that was 1/100,000th of the ones we have now, well, you get the point. So yes, size matters. In fact, our size also matters. So when that day comes, when a 1 and a 0 can be stored in something even smaller than an atom, given how big we are, we might not care. But actually, I think we will. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, it's the second part of a two-part series on digital health. This week, it's Dr. Rajay Batniji. He's the co-founder and chief health officer of Collective Health. Then on Biotech Nation, stopping blood loss in humans, whether by accident or during the course of a medical procedure, the animal studies are positive. If you've ever had a serious medical condition, or a member of your family had a serious medical condition, dealing with all the medical claims for your health insurance is a serious story in and of itself. Dr. Rajay Batniji is a co-founder and the chief health officer of Collective Health.
It really is. And actually, that frustration that every single person experiences in dealing with these medical claims is the reason we started Collective Health. And my background, I'm a physician. There I was treating patients at Stanford. I had done my doctorate working on the political economy of health, and I thought I knew something about how the system works. My co-founder, Ali, he actually was hospitalized at Stanford for an extended period of time. And, you know, when he got out, he had a mountain of these claims. And he's a very smart guy. He had been through a pretty intense illness, but he ended up getting over 65 explanations of benefits, many letters of denials of coverage. And there he was asking me, can you help me make sense of this? Because I don't know what's going on. And I'm calling my insurance company and they can't explain it to me either. And they just keep reading me some kind of script over the phone. So who's left to help people?
And this is a really accomplished guy. What was his background?
Yeah, I mean, Ali was incredibly accomplished. I mean, Ali's background is in consumer tech. He had been, you know, leading the search product team at Yahoo. He helped get another company in mobile advertising, AdMob, get started that was acquired by Google. And, you know, he was actually on a pretty rich health plan at the time.
If he can't figure it out,
then nobody can. And we actually know that to be true. And it's not just people don't understand their claims and their bills and the invoices. They don't even understand and the core levers of a health insurance plan. So if you go out there and you survey Americans and you ask them, do you know what a copay is and what a coinsurance and deductible and a maximum out-of-pocket is? 17% of people in this country across income and educational levels can answer one question about those things right. And there was actually on NPR a great episode not too long ago called Do You Speak Health Insurance, which asked similar questions to health insurance industry executives, and most of them can't get those questions right either. So the bottom line is we've made health insurance way too complicated to the point that people not only are frustrated and confused by the process when they have to use healthcare, but the levers that are meant to shape where they access care and when don't work because for those levers to work, we need to understand them.
Now, I have to say, I love your mission statement. It's way too long to read the whole thing here. But in the middle, there are two lines. It says, we don't want to dwell in the past or harp on what's wrong. We want to fix things now and for good. What the heck have you guys done?
We've started to fix things. And by no means is that quest complete. And that is the core mission, is we want to make healthcare work. The biggest, I think, deficit that we've had in health insurance in America today, and there are many, but the biggest is that we don't value what we're getting. We spend 20% of our GDP on healthcare and health insurance. And if you ask people, and if you ask the employers who are paying for 93% of that private sector health insurance spend, do your people appreciate what you're giving them? Do they understand the investment that you're making? Is the experience working for them across those areas? People are just saying no, because it's too complicated. When you try to use your health insurance, it usually just doesn't work. You end up hitting a roadblock. You get frustrated. You get confused. And that's true across income levels and educational levels. We just haven't created a health insurance system that works for people. And what we're doing at Collective Health is approaching those questions about how do you make this work? And it's not rocket science. It's health insurance. And maybe it's just as complicated. But we're approaching that focused on design.
Oh, rocket science. I've been there. It's easier.
You've been to rocket science.
A lot easier.
It's a lot easier. It maybe is, right? It's just combustion. This is a little more complicated, but we're trying to make it just as simple. And so actually, that's a bad analogy, saying just as simple as rocket science, but probably that would be progress.
I'll go with it.
That would be progress in this space. But we approach this really from a design perspective. I mean, we've got our design team went out there and we've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of members and trying to figure out, well, how do you put healthcare and health insurance into language that you understand? How do you make it feel less like a process and more like a product? And if you think about what your health coverage is today, it's just a set of processes. You're told that to access care, and if it's this type of care, you're going to pay 10% of the cost. And if it's this type of care, you're going to pay $150 flat. And you've also got these other cost levers that play in. What about saying it's going to cost you $200 to have a baby? And that's it. That includes everything. That includes your ultrasounds and your delivery and everything else. And so it's about and you know what? That comes with a guarantee and a warranty, and such that if you have a complication, you're not liable for those costs. So that really is a big part of this design, about how do you make healthcare something people understand. It's about changing our world from processes to products, and that's really at the core of what we're doing.
Now, you're aimed at companies of, I guess, 100 employees or more. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right. So we're not talking about individuals signing up for a particular health plan here, but we are talking about a new way of doing things. Take us through, for a company, what is it? How is it different for the members, for the employees?
Sure. So, yeah, we're working with employers that range in size from as small as 100 to as big as tens of thousands. And so the average employer is, you know, a few thousand employees that we're working with today. So what does it work? How does it look for them as members when they're experiencing Collective Health? And how does it work for the employer? Because it actually changes on both sides pretty dramatically. And so for the member, you go from getting some really confusing explanations of benefits and that frustrating experience of not knowing where to go.
If you've ever been in an employer that gave you two plans to choose from, you get two booklets, can't compare. You know, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So actually, even starting there, when you're making your plan choice, that's something that we do right away, which is we have a portal on our website that's actually created custom for each employer. It's configured for each employer that we work with, that actually lines up all of your plans and helps people make that right decision about which plan to pick based on who they are and what life events they're anticipating in the next year. And what we've seen is that, for example, you know, people that click on the maternity page, they're the most likely to then change plans because they know that, hey, I want to have a plan that actually is going to cover me during this major life event that I've got coming up. And so it's giving people that kind of heuristic guidance to make that plan choice with language and documentation that's in clear English to help them run through all the scenarios that relate just to them and their family about, you know, well, which plan is going to be right for me? So it's actually starting there with that kind of guidance, but then it goes all the way through that experience throughout the year. So most employers today, they give they're paying for their employees' health care. And, you know, what they do is they kind of just hand them over to, you know, one of the big insurance companies. And then the benefits team is left sort of answering questions because people are confused. The way we do it is we've got a team on our side and we have tools and on our website that answer all those questions, that make it easy to navigate healthcare, and more importantly, that bring everything together in one place. So if you're on an employer health plan today, you probably have an account for your wellness program and your telemedicine solution and you know whatever other point solutions for care management your employer has got in place. And each of those are separate logins and interfaces. And so with Collective Health, it's all just brought together in one place, intuitive, and it's really focused on getting people to the right care at the right time.
Now, does that mean that an employer might have a Collective Health plan and then some of the ones we're usually familiar with, such as Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Kaiser, go down the list, and Collective Health also collects all the plans that the employees have options for?
That's right. So Collective Health is that primary interface for all the plans that the employer is offering. And so we'll list the Kaiser plan as well as the plans that we administer. And Collective Health serves as an administrator, and we have partnerships where we allow our employers to connect to the best networks that exist. And so they can continue to use some of their, you know, those branded networks that you mentioned and actually have access to those via Collective Health. But we're doing all that claims administration, processing, customer support, and they're using the networks that they've selected for what those networks are really great at, which is making sure that they've got broad coverage and great rates.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Rajay Bhatnagji. He's a co-founder and the chief health officer of Collective Health, and he's a clinical assistant professor at Stanford University School of Medicine. In your expertise, if you will, and intention to make these things accessible and understandable is applied not just to your program, but all the programs that they are networked to.
That's exactly right. So we make it such that all of their programs work seamlessly with one another and that they, as the employer, only have one interface to access all of those programs. I think one statistic that surprises most people is that 65% of Americans that have private sector health insurance are on a self-insured plan. Now, what the heck does self-insurance mean? Self-insurance means that the employer is actually paying those doctor bills, those claims that come in.
They're being the insurer.
They are being the insurer.
So it's an employer-insured health plan, not some other health insurance company out there. It's the employer that says, okay, great, I'm actually insuring you. It's probably cheaper.
That's exactly right. So the employer is actually insuring the population. There is an insurance company that's typically involved, but what that insurance company is doing is they're acting just as an administrator. So they are basically facilitating that transaction, that financial transaction, and then the employer is still on the hook for all the claims. But this is the way most people in America have private health insurance. And it's shocking that these employers are basically running their own mini insurance companies, because that's effectively what they're doing. They're running their own mini insurance companies out of spreadsheets. They don't have software to run this huge part of their budget, you know, in many cases, 20% plus of total compensation, huge part of their spend. And they're sort of just managing it through file feeds and checks that they're writing. And it's kind of a mess.
How much do we have left in the coffers, Joe? What we're looking at?
In some cases, yes. I mean, we've had some employers tell us that they got hit with multi-million-dollar claims and they didn't even know that they were coming. I mean, that shows you just how bad that data connectivity is.
And hence, let's hire really young, healthy people.
Well, that's not exactly the strategy that we have the liberty of taking in this country. I mean, our workforce across sectors and across age groups, really, they are self-insured. And so, you know, one thing that's really remarkable is that, you know, these employers have used insurance companies to administer these plans, but you know, insurance companies tend to do things with people and process. You know, Zeke Emanuel in his last book writes about how there are two times as many people who work in the health insurance industry as there are doctors in America. And the way we approach this is let's do things with software and product, because A, we know from the rest of, frankly, everything that's happened in the last 25 years, that when you do things with software and product, people have a better experience. You can reduce costs. You can bring efficiencies that we couldn't have imagined. And to me, though, the starting point is that experience. I mean, people feel like when they're using their health insurance today, whether it's fully insured or self-insured, they often feel like they're sort of it's a throwback to 1980s technology, and you know, a user experience that really you wouldn't accept in any other part of your life. And we're actually bringing it to the modern era. So we're allowing these self-insured employers to not only deliver that, you know, experience that they think their members deserve, the experience that meets the expectations and investment that they're making in healthcare, but also one that allows them as an employer to manage their health spend and manage their health insurance program. Because again, they are a mini insurance company, to do that in a way that matches the way that they manage any other part of their business. It's kind of like how the sales team ran in spreadsheets before Salesforce, or how the HR team ran in spreadsheets before Workday, or how the finance team was running in spreadsheets before NetSuite. Health insurance is still running in spreadsheets for that employer. And in many cases, you know, even worse, because they don't even have the data to populate those spreadsheets. So we allow them to run their health plan so they've got access to all their data, their information in real time, while delivering that much better member experience driven by technology, data, and design.
Well, while we asked Joe how much was left in the coffers, the truth is it's if everybody is just going because they have a cold and that's where the numbers come from, that's different than if you have a number of people with chronic conditions or you have someone as Ali, the co-founder of the company, the CEO, you know, a serious unexpected medical condition shows up, and that comes right out of the company's coffers.
That's right. And when you ask these employers in say Ali's case, you know, what would you want done? And his case is remarkable because, you know, the reason that his insurance company denied his claims to begin with, he went into the hospital. He had what's known as a small intestinal volvulus, basically a small intestine twisting upon itself, and he had an emergency surgery. And they actually decided to reconnect his intestine rather than leave it open with a colostomy bag. And the insurer said, no, you shouldn't have reconnected it. You should have left it open and put in a colostomy bag. And that's because they're applying the same kinds of rules around, you know, return on investment that you'd apply if you took a 12-month view. But you know what? Employers don't take a 12-month view. Employers take a 4, 5, 7-year view on the health of their people. And employers would actually recognize, you know what, it's worth it to invest a little bit more now to dramatically improve the quality of life, as well as to dramatically reduce future costs. And that's the difference. And if you think about why the U.S. falls behind in almost any metric of public health, and we do, I mean, the World Health Organization did a ranking that they got a lot of criticism for that ranked the United States last among developed countries in the performance of our healthcare system. Part of that deficit is due to the fact that through our private insurance system, we are really taking a 12-month horizon, not a 5-year horizon. And while other countries can better justify their investment in public health and prevention, so can employers who also are taking that longer term horizon than a, you know, commercial insurer would. And so that's part of the difference here, is that employers are actually more willing to invest in preventive care, in wellness, in areas of chronic disease management that might not have a 1-year payback period because they can see out a little bit further.
Now, let me ask you in the terms of Ali, by just putting a colostomy bag in there, that procedure would have been cheaper in the moment, but wouldn't he be rehooked up later? Or
of course,
so that you would pay later anyway.
You would pay later, but that
next quarter or next year.
Next year, 5 years, 10 years out, and that's exactly the difference in time horizon. Where I think if you look at the way, you know, insurance works, it's, you know, these are publicly traded companies with a 12-month horizon. And employers are looking at this very differently. They're not looking at it from that financial year. They're thinking, this employee is going to be with me for at least 4 years. And I know that if I can do something today that's going to reduce their claims 3.5 years from now, then that's a good thing for me financially, to say nothing of the fact that I care about the wellness and happiness of my people. And the reason I'm offering them health insurance to begin with is because I want them to be taken care of. And I want them to see this benefit that comes with employment at my company.
Oh, there's also values and ethics. You're right. What's the best thing to do for this person that doesn't hurt anybody that we can do? You know, that's bringing that into the decision is different, you know, in a sense.
It is. It is. And that's where I think, you know, where there are benefits to our employer-sponsored health insurance system. Nobody would have ever created a system where employers pay for health insurance. It's unique. It's a historical anomaly. We can get into the origins of why that is. But part of the benefit of that is that I do think employers, like governments in many countries, do have values, ethics, longer time horizons that can help them provide better benefits to their employees. And to date, none of that has really been leveraged in a structured way. But at the core of it, there's a financial interest, which is employers are investing a whole ton of money in health benefits. And if you ask them, what are you not getting back? They tell you that their employees don't value that investment. Sometimes the employees don't know that it's coming from their employer. They don't understand that, you know, these aren't benefits that they could get out there on the market on their own, that these are unique to their employer. They reflect the culture of that employer. And it's culture, its ethics, its values, all of that, you know, bundled together to create this, I think, unique healthcare experience that employers are offering today.
Rajay, you're the chief health officer. Now, we understand there's two co-founders. You know, Ali was the CEO. That's everybody's got one of those. How did you get through and decide you'd be the chief health officer? There's lots of standard C-level jobs, but you became the chief health officer.
It's certainly not a role that you find in every company. I mean, for me, it was, you know, how do I combine my background in medicine, in political economy, and also use that and leverage it to deliver the product and service experience across our company? And so it's a role that I think we initially, when it was actually just four of us, came up with these, you know, maybe unusual titles. And for me, it was important to make sure that we weren't calling it chief medical officer, because that implies kind of a narrow focus on medical management and diseases. But it's actually chief health officer because it's thinking about the partnerships that we form with that broader healthcare ecosystem.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rajay Bhatnici, co-founder and chief health officer of Collective Health. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, a product to stop bleeding and blood loss. It's now to be tested in humans. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Rajay Bhatnagji, a co-founder and the chief health officer of Collective Health.
Initially, when it was actually just four of us, came up with these, you know, maybe unusual titles. And for me, it was important to make sure that we weren't calling it chief medical officer, because that implies kind of a narrow focus on medical management and diseases. But it's actually chief health officer because it's thinking about the partnerships that we form with that broader healthcare ecosystem. It's about the analytics that we do to inform the decisions that we advise our employers on. It's actually about the product that we build so that we can service our members and our employers so that they are optimizing for what we think should be the outcome that they're measuring collective health by, which is improvements in the health and happiness and productivity of their people. And so for me, it was important to make sure that, you know, whatever, and I don't really care about titles, but whatever title I had reflected that, you know, this was a mission-driven company with a pretty broad remit. And not to kind of narrowly focus it on, you know, maybe more of a conventional title that you'd expect at a healthcare technology company.
So there were four of you. One got the standard CEO. You got chief health officer. What were the other two positions?
Yeah. So, you know, what we do is obviously we're a technology company. And so we brought, you know, a chief technology officer is the other. And at the end of the day, healthcare and health insurance is actually a legal product in many ways. And so a chief legal officer was the next, you know, C-level post. So those were the four. Now we're a slightly over 200-person company, and we've added some other key posts across operations, commercial, and so there are some other C-level titles across the company in those areas. But it really is and has been an incredible journey for us to go from, you know, having an idea about, hey, we can make the health insurance system work better because, you know, we've been frustrated by it, to actually having, you know, an amazing product in the market, some really remarkable companies signing up to be our first cohort of customers, and you know, some backing by the best investors in technology.
Now, I want to go back to you. You said that you worked a lot on what was online, what was on the web, so you could see that. I'm assuming you also go in two other directions. One is you got to go mobile, and the other part of that is you got to go paper. I mean, if you've ever been hired by a big company, you sit down and they have a benefits person, and they usually give you like a bag with the company name on it, and they keep taking papers out and saying, here's your choices here, your choices there. That's why I guess you produce paper as well.
We do. And so you're exactly right. This is a technology-enabled solution. And that's what I think truly, you know, unique and differentiated. But across that service experience, the paper that you mentioned and the human, it's actually important to us that we fundamentally redesign that total experience. And so, yes, we do have paper products, but they look nothing like the paper products that you get from, you know, a traditional health insurance company. And, you know, we deliver our health insurance cards in a box that says, you know, this is the health insurance you deserve. And people take pictures of the box and they put it up on Instagram and Twitter. And
it's a gift.
It's a gift. It feels like it. And so our design ethos, it, you know, extends from those paper products and also includes, well, how do you pick your health plan? And let's give people a pamphlet that makes it so easy for them to pick their health plan. They'll walk out of that open enrollment meeting that their employer is holding and say, you know what? I just got all my questions answered by this pamphlet and I'm done. And that's exactly the kind of feedback we got. But it's also a human product and a human service. And we have our team on site and our member advocates answering questions from the time that an employer selects Collective Health all the way through the time that we're servicing them. And we've actually fundamentally redesigned that human experience too, so that you don't go through that normal frustration of calling your health insurance company of, well, my plan code starts with this and this is the claim number I'm referring to and all that. They know who you are when you're calling in. And if you happen to be using the technology product and you're looking on the screen at a certain claim that you've got questions about, then you live chat and our team knows exactly which screen you're looking at. So you don't have to go through that frustrating
experience. Together you look at the same screen.
Together you're looking at the same screen.
And you have a whole bunch of burly guys with deep voices who will yell at the insurance company. on our behalf?
The good news is we don't need to yell at any insurance.
Oh, good.
Because we are the administrator. That means we're the company that's processing those claims. We're the company that's telling, you know, determining and making the final determination on what's the cost sharing that the member has according to the legal document that is the plan. And so there aren't all these third parties that we need to call and yell at. I mean, that's the problem. When people so far have tried to fix health insurance, they've assumed that they couldn't, that the meat and the guts of health insurance, which is basically claims processing, that was an area that they should just never get into. And so you end up basically with a whole bunch of attempts that have never done that well to basically put lipstick on a pig. And what we've done is we've said, let's just re-engineer this from its core, because it's kind of like, why does Amazon sell books? They could have just been a platform for other people to sell their books and, you know, been maybe a deep, burly voice to yell at people that didn't fulfill their obligations. But that's not what we're doing. I mean, we actually are that hub. And by owning the transaction, that's the only way that you can make sure that the member experience is what you're promising and truly transformative. And it's also the only way to have real-time, unfettered access to all of the data. And at the end of the day, you can't rebuild the health insurance experience for an employer and not be the one transacting those claims. And that's why that is just so important to us. So the good news is we don't need deep, burly voices. We just need people on the other end of that phone that can actually solve that member's question using the technology that we have on our side.
And the other part of that is mobile. Can you access it mobily?
You can. So, you know, I think...
You know, you wake up in the middle of the night, you don't want to have to get in. You're just like, okay, how am I doing on this? Can you access it from your phone?
You can. And so you can see, you know, all aspects on your phone from, you know, how much have I spent year to date on healthcare, so that it looks like a credit card statement, not that you have to go then open up a whole stack of paper that you might have received in the mail. And so that's one aspect of it. You can find providers, and you don't need to go to 17 different mobile apps or websites. Everything for you is going to be in one place across, you know, medical, dental, vision, pharmacy. We're bringing that all together, plus all the other programs that your plan had in place. So we actually are mobile first. Our first employer was actually that signed up with us, had a very mobile workforce. Nobody was sitting at their desks, and that was a key prerogative. And so we actually think that that's just how people want to access personal information. When you're at work, you're looking at your laptop, but, you know, you're looking at your health insurance and your private health information. Oftentimes people prefer to access that on mobile. And so it really is that. And, you know, another key part of it is, you know, you can even download your ID card on mobile. And so you save it to your wallet on your iPhone or your passbook, and then you have that, and you go to the doctor's office and you got a mobile ID card. And that's the kind of thing that's like, it's just obvious. It's not that it's a dramatic, you know, reinvention to do
it's
that.
It's not even hard to do. You just
but
had to think to
it.
Do it.
But nobody's done it. And so that's the kind of thing that just, it's
But you
designed.
Do give them cards. There's a lovely box with cards in it. I saw the box. Yeah. But,
there is.
But that's not the only thing.
That's not the only thing. We've had several members actually call us and say, oh, I downloaded the card onto my app, so I'm just throwing my cards away. Is that okay? And we tell them, you know, we don't recommend it, but, you know, sure. you can do that.
You never have your card when you need it anyway.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And you can also just get onto our website and print a new card. I mean, again, these are the kinds of things that are just so simple that it's shocking they haven't really been done right. And we think it's about time that we just design it so that people can use health insurance and healthcare coverage the way that they should be using it.
Now, we don't want to let the cat out of the bag here, you know, but this is your first effort in making this whole thing better. What else do you have planned, or can you tell us?
Sure. So, you know, we are, you know, just getting started. And where we started out was, let's reinvent that health insurance experience for the member from beginning to end, from the time that they choose their plan to the point at which they're selecting a doctor, to the point at which they're accessing care, to the point that they're paying for that care. Let's completely reinvent that. And let's also completely reinvent this insurance experience for the employer, from the time that they're designing the health plans that they're going to offer to the time that they're putting together all of the different programs that augment that, like telemedicine or second opinions or whatever else they have in place for their own strategy, to the way that that plan is reported on so they can track the utilization. That in itself is a pretty monumental effort and has really been the focus of our engineering and product and design teams. But there's a lot more in the works. I think that a few of the areas that we're investing in heavily are, how do you manage those people that have chronic disease and those people that are, you know, utilizing healthcare frequently in a much more creative, high-touch, technology and data-driven way than we've ever done before?
For example?
For example, somebody who is about to have a major surgery or is undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, today, you know, the way it works is they have a care manager at the insurance company who might, you know, call them and have a conversation or read a script in many cases about, you know, this is what you should be thinking about. And that feels really removed for that member. People are telling us that they want to have a really focused experience and a technology-focused and driven experience so they can communicate by email through the mobile app with regard to their chronic disease management. And we're beginning to build out that capacity. We're also, as I mentioned at the very beginning, beginning to turn more and more that is stuck in the world of process to convert that into the world of product. And that goes through from the way the plan is designed so that now when you look to the future, you shouldn't have to have, you know, and you're planning to grow your family, you shouldn't have to have a line item that says, you know, office visit copay, my co-insurance when I'm delivering in the hospital, my, you know, follow-up postnatal visit.
Been there, done that.
You know, all that. This is how much
like,
a, you
whoa,
know, a pump is going to cost
you.
It's just, it's too much. And so you should be able to tell your members, you know what? If you go to X hospital, having a baby is $400. And that includes everything, every part of care. And if you go to Y hospital, having a baby might be free. And that is going to be a guarantee. And so the employer can do that. Again, the only reason they haven't is just some of the complexity around claims administration that prohibits that. And so we're working to create those sort of productized care experiences that reach the, you know, everybody, as well as that focus on those members that and those people that, you know, suffer from a chronic disease, to make it so that they can have a champion, an advocate, and an ally as they navigate that. And frankly, to make it so that they don't even need that champion, advocate, or ally, because it becomes so simple and so intuitive and so obvious for them to make the right decisions at the right time about how and where they access care.
I always think that bad technology shouts out to me, we need a human here. But good technology can often do many of the things that humans do really well. So you're kind of moving from the one side of the bad technology, like, okay, we got humans here, we're going to try to get the good technology in where we can.
I couldn't have imagined saying that better. Actually, one of the things that for us early on illustrated that was, you know, when we first launched into open enrollment, we brought on board about, you know, 34,000 members at the beginning of the year.
Whoa.
And when we first launched into open enrollment, we had really staffed up our member advocate team and prepared everyone for, you know, a huge spike in calls. And what we found was we were getting a tiny fraction of the calls that we had anticipated based on, you know, what everybody else in the industry might say you should expect per member. And the reason was people were using the website to have their questions answered about what's covered in the plan, what the differences are among the plans, and which plan they should be electing into. And so you're exactly right that when you give people good technology, frankly, good information.
And good design. You haven't scanned all the frequently asked questions. You're trying to, you know, you did a search. It says, oh, we got nothing for you. It's like if it's well designed, you're going to find it.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. You need humans to navigate the pieces that are broken. And again, I shared earlier, there are two times as many people who work in the health insurance industry as there are doctors in America. And that to me is a symbol of how complicated this is for people to navigate, that we need that many people involved. And good technology and good design can greatly reduce that need for manual human interaction.
Well, Rajay, thank you so much. Please come back. See us anytime.
It's been a pleasure, Moira. Thank you.
My guest today is Dr. Rajay Bhatnagji. He's the co-founder and chief health officer of Collective Health. More information is available on the web at collectivehealth.com. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about stopping blood loss in humans, whether by accident or during the course of a medical procedure. For as we all know, blood loss is serious business. Interestingly enough, the technology we're talking about today didn't start with a life scientist or a medical professional, but rather many years ago with an electrical engineer and his brother. Riff Pamukachu is the CEO of RXMP Therapeutics in Miami, Florida. I thought I would open with a simple question. Who is Wallace Coulter?
Several decades ago, he was one of our earliest biomedical engineers, even though that degree didn't exist all the way back then, decades ago. But he invented the Coulter counter, he and his brother. The Coulter counter is used to count our blood work. So the number of red cells, white cells, platelets, that was all the Coulter counter that eventually, that developed into a big multinational company and got sold to another big multinational company. And he left a legacy of leaving $750 million to try to translate scientific inventions at the bedside by my biomedical engineers coupled with physicians into the clinic and get them to the patient. So Wallace, that's where Wallace started. But this invention, this technology is actually invented by Wallace's physician.
Everybody around him was very inventive.
Absolutely. And that physician, who is a faculty member in the Department of Hematology at the University of Miami, Dr. Yian An, he noticed that patients with an autoimmune disease that caused them to have low platelet counts that would spontaneously bleed. Those patients, if they had a higher level of these red cell membrane particles floating around in their bloodstream, that those patients were less likely to bleed. So he followed that observation forward and said, if we make these particles, and they obviously they're naturally occurring in the body, but if we artificially make them from red cells that are donated, that you can get at the Red Cross and other agencies, if you make those particles and you administer them into animal models of bleeding, would it make a difference? And across various animal models of slow oozing to very rapid bleeding, there was a dramatic reduction in the amount of bleeding. In fact, if you take rabbits and if they develop a laceration in their liver, for example, they'll bleed out in an hour. You give them the microparticles IV, and these are almost like tiny little smart bombs. They go to the site of bleeding, stick at the site of bleeding, and help accelerate the process of clotting and form a better clot at the area. Those animals, when given the red cell membrane particles, stop bleeding within 15 to 20 minutes. And all of those animals would survive where the other animals would go on to die of blood loss.
So Dr. An noticed that the people with more red blood cell particles are healing faster. Now you've got to figure out, well, how do we make more of them?
Right. So the company, the way you make them is interesting. This is not a chemical reaction. This is all mechanical. So you take red cells from donors, you put them under very high pressure, and you blow them through a little pinhole in metal.
And they break apart.
And they just break apart. They break apart, and then the little fragments form tiny little spherical vesicles themselves. And you can now freeze dry these vesicles, put them on the shelf, and it appears that they're stable for over a year. And if you have somebody who is bleeding excessively, you can reconstitute them with saline, inject them IV, and at least in animals, it works. And now we just have to demonstrate that this holds up in humans as well.
Well, how well does it work in animals?
In animal models of excessive bleeding, we can see a, number one, a very pronounced increase in survival of the animals, and we see a 30 to 40% reduction in their overall blood loss.
So we're seeing marked change.
We think that if you extrapolate from the animal to the human condition, we think that in situations of surgery where there's high levels of blood loss, people can lose up to 20% of their blood volume. Now, we try to recycle those cells and give them back to the patient, but you're still giving lots of transfusions in addition to that. And we think that for every unit of blood we convert to these microparticles, we may be able to save a patient anywhere between 4 to 9 units of blood. So it could have a big effect on our worldwide blood supply in those serious cases. And it looks like it's very cost effective and could actually save healthcare dollars in doing that.
Well, what about blood types? We've always been trying to match blood types. Do they come into play
here? Yeah, they still come into play here. We think that the particles are probably going to still have to be typed, you know, like O positive, A negative, A positive, B positive and negative. We still think that that's going to have to happen in the beginning. It may turn out not to be the case later on because the lifespan of these particles in the bloodstream is very short. It's less than half an hour, in some cases, you know, 15 minutes. And so that might not be long enough for anybody to develop antibodies
to have a reaction.
To have a reaction, right. And in fact, we think that by removing a lot of the other components that come with the red cells, that if we're lucky, we will reduce the number of transfusion reactions. So the cost to the healthcare system right now for blood transfusions and all of the transfusion reactions and other problems, I think, is approximately $26 to $27 billion a year in the U.S. Yeah.
Do we know what these red blood cell particles do when they enter the body?
We believe, and we've got some publications coming out in the future that are going to discuss this further. We believe what happens is that these particles, when these particles form, actually half of these particles form inside out. Right?
Inside out.
Inside out. So when you break open a membrane, it can either form back the way a red cell was in a regular sphere, or it can form as a sphere that's inside out.
Sort of like taking the inside of an orange, and you could actually take
flipping
it inside out.
Right. And what we believe is occurring is that these particles, whether they're inside out or not, are as they're going through circulation, when you have a break in the blood vessel, you're exposing collagen. And while platelets attach to it, we believe these red cell microparticles are also attaching themselves to components in the wall that are now exposed and then provide sort of a scaffolding that all sorts of other coagulation enzymes and all of the things that are involved in platelets binding and clot formation, that all of those things end up getting stuck there in close proximity, so they work much more efficiently and faster.
And they close the leak.
And they close the leak.
It's so interesting when we can assist the body do what it does naturally.
Right.
And we still know that frequently the best way to do it is to use the body itself.
Right. And that's what was – to me personally, that was the most intriguing thing about this, is that we were taking what was really a natural substance, creating it artificially outside and then reintroducing it. So what we envision in the future is that since we can measure the number of particles already circulating in your bloodstream, we envision being able to do a test that says – you, the patient, have a normal level of microparticles, so you're not likely to bleed. You, the patient, have a low-level microparticles, and you are at greater risk at the time of surgery for bleeding. And so you might benefit from having your microparticle levels boosted very transiently just for the beginning of the surgery. So that's the sort of direction we believe this will eventually head toward.
This is very exciting. We're at the very beginning of what can happen. There's going to be a lot of ups, downs, right turns, left turns.
Right. Science is never linear.
Never. It's like, oh, we thought this was going to work and it didn't, but we didn't know anything about that and we got lucky over here. We learned that you're right there at the beginning. So this is an exciting time.
Right. And we are working on other modified versions of particles to see if we can get them to do things even faster. But the evidence that we've seen so far is that the particles that we normally see circulating in the bloodstream, in January there was a publication that came out in patients that were having their coronary arteries repaired for heart attacks and the like. And they found that if you looked at the number of microparticles before surgery, the number of microparticles were predicting who was going to have transfusions and who wasn't. So from those early observations in the patients that had low platelets, now we've come into a much larger group of patients, you know, all the patients having heart surgery for blocked vessels, where we're seeing the same sort of thing holding true. When the tests we would like to run in the first patient group that we'd like to run this in are patients that are having spinal fusion surgery. And so if you fuse more than three vertebrae together, you get a lot of oozing and those patients can lose up to 20% of their blood volume at the time of surgery. And so we would like to give these particles to those patients prophylactically at the time of surgery to try to prevent them from having that much oozing and lose that much blood, because they can get many, many units of blood being administered in the OR.
Well, Riff, thanks so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to hear the story.
Riff Pamukkachu is the CEO of RxMP Therapeutics in Miami, Florida. More information is available on the web at rxmpt.com. Wallace Coulter's legacy lives on in the Wallace H. Coulter Foundation, dedicated to furthering biomedical innovation and helping innovators take their inventions from the bench to the market where they can directly benefit patients. More information on the Coulter Foundation and its annual event, Coulter College, can be found on the web at whcf.org. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.